Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
In each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, we're so excited because our guest is Stephen Graham Jones. He's a prolific author who's written novels such as Your Heart is a Chainsaw, The Only Good Indians, and Night of the Mannequins. The second issue of his comic, co-written with Joshua Viola, True Believers, is available to support now on Kickstarter, and The Angel of Indian Lake, the final novel in his Indian Lake trilogy, is out now. Plus, he has a book coming out later this year. Are you busy enough? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm proud to be here. Man, I pulled up to the house on my mountain bike at 9 minutes before this podcast started. That's why my hair is still wet.
Hell yeah.
That's amazing. You're just rolling on in your motorcycle.
Did you see the eclipse?
I did, yeah. I was outside eating a hamburger in the backyard, and I remembered it was happening because the light all looked weird, and so I went inside and got my eclipse glasses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I saw your tweet. Were you reading Bury Your Gaze? And you're like, why is everything weird?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a book in which you kind of question your reality, you know? And so it was a weird way to read the book, you know?
is that Chuck Tingle's new book?
Yeah, so good.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait. We loved Camp Damascus. So we got to chat with him about that. And that was, that was what an interesting individual. Okay. Oh, so, but we're here to talk about you. So let's talk about True Believers. First of all, the first issue was kickstarted, and now we're doing a Kickstarter for the second issue. And it looks like there's some cameos involved as well. Can you tell listeners a little bit about this project?
Oh yeah. Well, I guess it started when Josh and I have been friends for, man, I don't know, 10 years, maybe longer. We live pretty close to each other here in Colorado, and he called me up, or no, we ran into each other at a convention, and he said, hey, why don't you write a comic book for this? And I said, man, I ain't got no time. And so we went through that dance for like months. Like, that's how it always is to get me on a project. You have to talk to me like 87 times, you know? And finally, I was at a layover somewhere out east on an airport, and I had a little time, 45 minutes or so, and so I wrote most of the first script, sent it to Josh, and he dug it. And at that time, he had only been asking for an 8-page script, but left little places in the script on like splash pages where the splash page could possibly open up to a 2-page spread. So it became a 12-page comic really quickly. And then Ben got involved, Ben Matsuya, the artist, and did amazing stuff. And then Josh pretty much wrote the back half of True Believers. So that's why both our names are on it. But tell you the truth, the idea was his too. He said, let's do a slasher at a con. And he didn't give me any more than that. And so I took off. And then, you know, originally the killer, K-I-L-L-R, trademark symbol. I'm not sure how to say that trademark symbol, actually. it's a running joke through all three issues as it accumulates. That was initially a placeholder name because I thought I'll think of a Jason Voorhees type name later. But I never did. And then killer just became how we referred to this killer, and it stuck, you know, and it seems to work out.
I love that. Mm-hmm. Are you releasing them yearly with to go with the convention?
Correct.
Cool. Okay.
I think that's generally how it goes. At this last convention, the Colorado Festival of Horror, we released samples. Was it sample? I think it was samples of issue one. I don't know if it was the whole thing or not. It's hard for me to remember because I've got the whole thing in my hand, but I'm not exactly sure when it got in my hands anymore, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, and like, I've talked to you about True Believers before, and then Earth Divers was also the comic that you worked on. Do you have any more comics that you're working on, or is that something you want to keep diving into?
You know, yeah, Earth Divers is going to be wrapping up soon. Before that, I've done Memorial Ride, I've done My Hero, I've done some one-shot things for different places. Comics are one of my very first and most abiding loves. So I think I'll always keep a foot in comic book land. The trick is, like, True Believers happening pretty much at once a year. That's not too much to juggle. Earth Divers, a monthly serialized comic book, that's a lot to juggle. Yeah, it's like when I initially got in, I thought, hey, this is just going to be, I write a script, and then it takes 2 hours to write a script, and I'm off for the rest of the month. But that is not the case, man. I have to be involved at the pencils, at the inks, at the lettering, at the colors, and there's so many adjustments. Like, there's endless adjustments to be made if you wanted to match up to your conception of it. You know, I think there are writers who maybe they're good enough at writing scripts that they can write a script and just drop it off with the publisher and walk away and do something else and trust that it's going to open up the way they want it to open up. But maybe I'm just too much of a micromanager. I don't know. I like to stay involved so I can, I say quality control. It's not like I don't trust the people I work with. I do. They're amazing. Like Maggie Howell is my editor, and she is really on top of things. She keeps me straight as far as story and narrative goes and issues. But, nevertheless, I feel like I would hate for something of mine to find the shelf and for it to have some glaring error or just an absence where I could have made something better, you know? And so therefore I stay involved the whole way.
That's cool. But it must give you a better appreciation, though, for like all of the work that goes into making a comic, because it's not just, oh, someone throws a script down and someone just like colors it. Like, it's so much more like the layering up of all of the different parts. Like, you must have such a deeper appreciation for the medium,
not just the medium, but for the creators, because most like artists, just because drawing is art, is so work intensive, they can generally just juggle one title at a time. Writers, in order to like make a living with comics, they'll generally juggle five or six if they can, and if you're doing it full time, I think it's manageable. I don't think I could do five or six. I don't know if I have the like mental bandwidth to do that, you know?
It's not like you're that's also teaching and writing novels and all that other stuff. Like, whatever, it's fine. How has the reception been for the end of your trilogy? And how does that feel for you as a writer to be done with that in a way? That's got to be such a weird experience to be done with that series.
It is it's weird to say goodbye to Jay Daniels. It's weird and lonely, and it's happy at the same time. But you know what means the most is so many people are writing in or posting or letting it be known in some fashion that Jade like helped them through a part of their lives that was tough, that was muddy, you know, or that they saw on the page in Jade a piece of themselves and they felt less alone. And that's what's really the most meaningful, you know. I mean, yeah, they're selling well and they're, you know, getting all kinds of traction, and that's great. But what you really do art for is to connect with people, you know? And I feel like the Indian Lake trilogy is connecting with people in a way that I like, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Hell yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's got to be crazy to have such an impact. Like, that to me is, like you said, like what art is so good at is making connections with people. And I know we met someone. So we were, side note, Terry and I were at a film festival. We went to a bookstore called Borderland Books in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And we were talking to someone, was like, I love Stephen Graham Jones. And I'm like, oh my God, we're having him on our podcast. And she was like, I'm so excited to listen. So like, I mean, it's cool. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. If you end up in San Francisco, you need to go to Borderland Books, because they are huge fans of yours.
Slip. And also, it's all horror sci-fi books at the bookstore. So like, it's cool, and it's right on the main street of Haight-Ashbury by Amoeba Music. So like, it's the place to go.
Oh, it is
nice.
So if you ever find yourself in San Francisco, highly recommend that.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you.
But I want to know what was the first slasher you ever saw? Because obviously you have a love for that subgenre, and I would love to hear like how that started for you.
You know, I guess the first slasher I ever sort of saw was not really a slasher. It's The Eyes of Laura Mars, that John Carpenter written movie from the late 70s. You know, it's a lot more giallo than it is slasher. It's kind of like the Dario Argento brand of giallo, where it gets kind of supernatural, you know? I didn't really understand what I was watching, because I would have seen this in about 81 on HBO probably, so I would have been 9 years old, and I don't think everything landed as it was supposed to land. Nevertheless, I liked it. But I honestly, I've tried to remember the very first slasher I saw, and I cannot remember, because as I say in the back of My Heart's a Chainsaw, in eighth grade, we would all bring home like six at a time clamshell VHS slashers from the rental store. And the one I remember the best from that period is Friday the 13th 4, you know, where Tommy Jarvis comes at Jason with a machete. That's the one that imprinted on me the deepest, I think. But, I mean, Freddy, not the original Nightmare on Elm Street imprinted on me pretty good, too. And which one is it? Is it number, let's see, is it 4 or 5 where the girl has a cockroach fear and then she turns into a cockroach?
It's 4, my favorite Nightmare on Elm Street.
I know, 4 is underrated. Everybody loves Dream Warriors and I love Dream Warriors too.
4 is underrated.
Oh, 4, it's got that wonderful gear up sequence, you know?
Yes!
Yeah.
Terry has instilled a deep love of Alice in my heart too, so Alice fucking rules.
Yeah, she does. She is bad.
It's so funny because you talk about like coming home with a bunch of clamshells. Yeah. 4 was the only Nightmare on Elm Street movie I owned, and I owned a beta copy that was like stuffed in a VHS tape like box, and that's how the video store sold it. Wow. And so I had that one, and that is the one that I watched over and over and over again because in the 80s, that's what you do. You know, you get a movie and you don't have access to all of them. And so that was the one I like was obsessed over.
Yeah, you know, we would always in the 80s. In high school, you know, we'd always have different fake ID scams because we thought we could buy alcohol, you know, and we always get
it
almost never worked, you know, because you know, people at 7-Eleven have like standards and stuff, you know, they're not gonna but the Blockbusters did not have the same standards, so we could take our McLovin IDs to Blockbuster and get all the movies we want and never bring them back, you know, and that was really wonderful.
That
who needs cigarettes and booze when you can get horror movies at Blockbuster?
I always feel bad because Blockbuster like fell apart. Now wonder, was it us getting movies with different names?
Single-handedly you that took down the Blockbuster with your fake ID scam.
Oh man, so we're kind of talking about like childhood stuff. Do you remember how you got introduced to the horror genre?
I do. It was a Thanksgiving when I was probably, if I had to guess, I was 10. I was the oldest grandkid, the oldest cousin. There were probably like a passel of 10 of us, maybe 12, I don't know. And every Thanksgiving we'd all meet at my grandma's house, and the adults, they just wanted to take off and play cards or something. They didn't really want to mess with us kids, of course. And so they had to find something to do with us, and they couldn't let us play out in the pastures because there was, I mean, it'd be November, so there weren't snakes, but there was all kinds of trouble to get up to outside, you know, because it was West Texas. And so this Thanksgiving, my uncle shows up with a VCR he had rented from the gas station, one of those big ones. It's like so wrapped in plastic, you know, it's like in 2001. Yes. So if you drop it, it's not going to matter. And he had gotten a handful of Disney movies, just kind of randomly picking them off the shelf at the gas station. And one of them he had got was Watcher in the Woods. And so we got stashed back in my grandmother's bedroom, all like 10 of us. And I was the oldest by 3 years. And the rest of the kids, they just rested on the ground for 2 hours. But I was sitting in front of that TV and I watched Watcher in the Woods, and that fundamentally disturbed me, and that movie still creeps me out when I watch it.
It's really freaky. We actually, someone brought that on as a pick one time, and that was the very first time that I'd ever seen it, I'm pretty sure. Yep. But it still as an adult, it's freaky.
It is. And did y'all watch the extra features on that one? The
No.
Yeah, it's got some original endings that go really creepy and dark, man. Like it kind of got Disney-fied or sanitized for, you know, theatrical release, but man, it's got some original endings that are actual horror, you know.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah, I mean, Disney at that period was doing some dark things, like
they were.
Surprisingly. And I think it's so funny to see the corporation now and what it puts out for kids and how, you know, gentle it is. Whereas like in the 80s, man, between that and like I'm trying to think of some of the other ones that that were Disney-ified back then. But like there was a lot of horror adjacent or horror things that were just, I think, took kids seriously, really.
Yeah.
And didn't like try to talk down to them.
You know, what's it? Mallory O'Meara, she talks about that big demon in Fantasia, is that right? That one that comes up over the mountain?
Yeah.
You know, that scarred like a whole generation. I believe her. I've still never seen Fantasia. Maybe I'm too scary to see it, but I don't know.
There's some great moments in Fantasia, I will say. This?
Get fucked up and watch it. If that is something that you enjoy doing. It's fun to watch that way as an adult. For sure. Because it's pretty. It's just like, it's really, if you love animation, it's worth watching. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's why I've never watched it, because I always think this is, it's like a look at our cool animation, you know, how we can be syrupy and mix it with music, you know, and that's all, and you're right, that's really neat and fun to watch in certain circumstances, you know?
Circumstances, yes, absolutely. So you saw Watcher in the Woods, how did that affect you? Like, did you have, I know we'll talk more about your Scarred for Life pick, but like, did that give you kind of an interest in looking into horror from there? Like, what was that like? Did it set you on a path?
You know, I don't know if it set me on a path, but it did imprint upon me. Like, I feel like this whole Indian Lake trilogy that I did feels a lot like me paying homage back to Watcher in the Woods. It's about little girl who gets lost and then comes back, you know, 10 years later or whatever. And that's kind of what... the story that Angel of Indian Lake is based on, called Raphael at Random Cemetery Dance back in 06, that story is, like, to me, fan fiction of Watcher in the Woods, and then Indian Lake comes from Raphael.
Wow.
That story is still finding ways out through my fingerprints, I guess. But no, Watcher in the Woods didn't tell me to go hunt down horror. However, starting probably in about sixth grade, maybe fifth grade, we were all passing around illicit Faces of Death VHS tapes, you know?
Oh, my goodness.
Yes! Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
And they were like that and Queen's Greatest Hits were like the two contraband medias, you know? and we would, you know, wait until the parents went to bed and we'd cuddle around a TV in somebody's basement or living room and watch those Faces of Death and cover our eyes. The thing that pulled me into horror, it might be Faces of Death. Yeah.
Wow.
Whoa. So you had like the full on like Faces of Death experience, like bootleg weird copy you watched in the basement on a VHS. That's fucking cool.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Are you excited for the remake?
Yeah, there is a remake. Yeah, I don't know. I'll watch it, I'm sure. Sounds like it's going to have a narrative instead of just like weird things, you know?
I'm super curious how they're going to do it. But you know what? Mm-hmm. We'll see. We'll see.
For sure.
He did How to Blow Up a Pipeline, and I really loved that movie. So I have faith.
Okay.
I have faith in him.
Excellent.
But were you easily scared? Were you a super scared kid?
Oh, yeah. I'm a super scared adult, too. I think that's why I write horror, because I'm scared. Because I believe in this stuff, or I can't not believe in this stuff, you know? I think... it's like Pascal's wager. Like it is more beneficial to believe than to not believe. You know, finally, it's safer. Not believing in werewolves means I could eventually fall prey to a werewolf because I'm not being vigilant enough. Whereas believing in werewolves is not going to hurt me in any way. You know,
that's true. Was this how you were as a kid too? I have like very vivid memories of a kid watching the movies and taking down like this is how you kill Freddy, this is how you would kill like Jason, like and knowing every single movie and figuring out how to do that. Is that something? It sounds like that might be something you did too, kind of.
You know that not as like I didn't keep notes because I couldn't keep up with notes, but and I never had a pen or a pencil on me either, but I was watching them. But I guess another way to say it, maybe the way best way to say it is every 2 weeks we would go to the grocery store because we lived way out in the country. And my mom, we'd get there at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon right after school. My mom would ditch my brother and I at the magazine rack while she went and shopped for 2 hours and talked to people. It was like a social thing. And I would read Weekly World News and Inquirer. And I would read those. And I'm like in fourth grade and I don't understand that they're not real. You know, I think that Bigfoot took this dude as a love slave. This is crazy. There's a bad boy. I can't believe it. I had no critical critical defenses, you know? And so all that stuff went into me and stayed there and became part of me. And my Bible back then it's one of those Reader's Digest kind of, I don't know, encyclopedias called Strange Stories, Amazing Facts. I lived with that book. I read that book over and over and over. It's got like disappearances and ghost hitchhikers and just all that kind of stuff. And it still terrifies me. And I remember from about fourth grade until maybe seventh or eighth grade, I had to sleep touching that book. Because if it accidentally spilled open while I was asleep, then whatever was in it might escape and get me, you know? So I had to sleep with that book.
That's amazing.
That's fucking
it's so
incredible.
Funny the mm-hmm. things we do as kids that like mm-hmm. you know it's mm-hmm. like I gotta do this otherwise it's gonna get me.
exactly
but I do want to focus on Weekly World News, that's what it's mm-hmm. called, right? Yeah, so it's so insidious as a kid because it's placed in like the magazine racks, at least in the grocery stores that I would go to, right yeah. next to like the Reader's Digest or right next mm-hmm. to like regular newspapers. And so like kid, and it's printed on like, it was printed on old like newspaper almost, it felt like. And I'm like, is this real? Like it yeah. makes you feel real. So I can completely understand mm-hmm. not understanding between that and National Enquirer, because yeah. I was the same way. I was like, Bad yeah. Boys, I want to see Bat Boy.
Exactly. And JFK's alive and living on an island. And why is he doing that? We need that yeah. dude, you know?
Elvis is just chilling in Las Vegas somewhere. Like, everyone's alive. No one's really dead. It's just... And I believed it too. And my dad yeah. would always fuck with me too yeah. and be like, yeah, Bat Boy's real. I thought Bat Boy was real for way longer mm-hmm. than was probably normal for a child. But you know what? Joke's on all of us when he ends up being real for real.
I know, for sure. You know? Well, I mean, we all saw The Descent. That's practically Bat Boy, you know?
It really is. Oh, my God.
They did a musical, Bat Boy the Musical, and wow. I got to see that performed at a local community playhouse, and what a joy
wow. that was. Oh, that's amazing. That's beautiful.
That is
Man,
incredible.
I love that. But you know, but growing up in West Texas like I did, and believing in all this stuff, when I was like 12 years old, I realized, you know, our bodies are changing and I'm becoming something else. And I kind of thought it was volitional. I could decide what I was going to become. And so I thought, am I going to be a vampire or a werewolf, you know? And I knew that in West Texas, being a vampire was going to be instant death because there's no shade, you know? It's all sunlight. Oh, yeah. And so I was deeply invested in becoming a werewolf. I was doing all the tricks you could do to become a werewolf. I somehow found lore. And like, you could get bitten by a werewolf, but I couldn't find any werewolves to bite me, you know? And one way I found to become a werewolf was if a werewolf had left a print in the ground and water had filled that print and you drank water from that print, you'd become a werewolf. And
what?
Oh.
Yeah. And so I went to my grandma. I lived with my grandma a lot, and she had a really muddy long driveway, and I got the garden hose out there and I got it real muddy. And then I went to sleep and got up the next morning and ran out there. And sure enough, there are these big prints all in it. And I mean, there's a 99.9 chance it was all the dogs we had, you know, but I could tell myself it was a werewolf. And so I got down, right. I drank all the water from the deepest print I could find, you know.
Did it work? Are we secretly talking to a werewolf shirt,
so like I feel yeah, like yeah. you're... yeah. Wait, where in West Texas did you grow up?
Oh, 20 miles east of Midland, Texas. Place called okay. Greenwood, and also Stanton.
I only ask because my aunt has family in Alpine, Texas, which I'm not sure if that's considered West Texas, but it's like very, I know it's very like, not, yeah. it's very rural, to put it lightly.
It is,
like,
yeah.
There, it's a lot of cattle farm, like cattle ranches.
Yeah, you know, people who aren't in West Texas call Alpine West Texas. We in West Texas call Alpine kind of South Texas, but it technically okay. probably technically it probably is West Texas.
Again, yeah, it's way down. I don't know Texas very well.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I wrote a werewolf cool. novel set down Alpine actually, but I never published it. It wasn't good enough. Yeah.
Oh. Well. Wait. So okay, we'll probably get into this with your pick, but before I won't ask about werewolves yet. But what is the scariest movie you've seen as of late that has scared you and reminded you of being a kid again?
That's a good question. Probably Talk to Me. I think Talk to Me was pretty disconcerting, you know?
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That one messed me up seeing that one. That was, yeah. that was a good one.
Yeah, it was.
That's the new disturbing movie of this century, which I'm okay with. It's
yeah.
Wow. Off-putting.
Yeah, it really is. It really is off-putting. I agree. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So, Stephen, we've talked about your horror history, your works, but mm-hmm. what movie did you bring with you today for us to discuss?
Joe Dante and John Sayles' The Howling from 1981.
Fuck yeah. All right. In The Howling, after a bizarre and near-deadly encounter with a serial killer, a television newswoman is sent to a remote mountain resort whose residents may not be what they seem.
All right. So take us back. How old were you when you saw this? How did you see this? What about it terrified you? Give us your horror story. I want to know why this was your Scarred for Life pick.
You know, I I wish I could tell you the exact age I was. I know I was in first grade or second grade. And the way I know that is because from my first and second grade, we moved into town. And the house we moved into town in Midland, Texas, had cable still hooked up to it. So we just plugged the TV in and had cable. And I had always had like 2.5 stations. So I was watching like Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver and Gunsmoke. Those were like the things I thought were real. But then suddenly HBO, you know, like Flashdance and all this stuff. I had no idea that there was movies like that. And somehow I got left alone in the living room, probably not at the house, but at least in the living room. And The Howling was somehow on HBO. That's my best guess. It was on television somehow. I don't think it would have been a VCR tape because we didn't, that was like 80, this would have been what, 81, 82, you know, we wouldn't have had a VCR really. They weren't that popular or they weren't that pervasive then, I don't believe. But I remember watching it. I don't think I saw the whole thing either. I think I came in probably 20, 30 minutes into it. So I didn't, okay. I don't think I would have understood the story anyways. But the part that scarred me were those claymation werewolves standing in the road, you know, because part of me could tell those aren't 100% real, but that just made it worse, you know, like it wasn't me seeing through the effects. It was me being like, these monsters are even weirder than I thought they were, you know, and that really was disturbing to me, and it really imprinted on me quite deeply. And I've been watching The Howling closely ever for like the 40 years since then, you know.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine seeing that sort of claymation, because it was claymation, mm-hmm. wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Stop motion. Yeah. So seeing that stop motion and knowing that not only is this horrific because they're werewolves, but there's something mm-hmm. very off about it.
Yeah.
That, yeah, I could see that. Mm-hmm. when I saw this as a kid, I don't remember much about it, but I remember mm-hmm. being really upset with the way the film opens, because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, you watch like a bunch of horror movies by that point, you watch a bunch of werewolf movies, and I'm sitting here and I'm like, okay, this is taking place in a city and we're following this woman in a very seedy part of the town, mm-hmm. and I'm like, where does the werewolf come in? And I remember mm-hmm. being like really upset in the beginning and then being really kind of bored as a kid mm-hmm. until like the werewolves happened, because I was like, mm-hmm. I don't understand what's going on here. I thought I was getting into werewolves because I had seen like, you know, Wolfman. I grew up with like the Wolfman and like mm-hmm. all of that type of stuff. And so seeing this and I'm mm-hmm. like, where does the werewolf come in? But it was that beginning moment for me that just like yeah. as a kid really rocked my world. I was like, this is making me feel weird.
No, that opening, it launches us into a very grimy narrative space and it's quite uncomfortable, yeah. you know? And,
yeah.
And then it's confronting you with that like made up snuff or rape film or whatever it is in the arcade, that booth, you know? And you're like, this is entertainment, you know? This is awkward. Right. Yeah.
I had actually never seen this before and I don't know why. I think it was just a blind spot, and I had no idea what it was about, really, because I had seen American Werewolf in London, and they came out the same year, which is mm-hmm. wild.
So did Wolfen. Wolfen came out that year, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I was like, oh, well, I love American Werewolf in London. This was me being a snobby younger person. I was like, mm-hmm. there's no way The Howling could better it. And I watched it today, mm-hmm. and I was like, this is the most harrowing movie and the most harrowing werewolf movie I've ever seen. Like, this isn't just mm-hmm. werewolves for the sake of werewolves. This is talking about sexual abuse and PTSD through mm-hmm. the werewolf. And so, yeah. and like, a way that I'm, like, not beating myself up, but I'm like, how did I never see this? Because, like, sexual assault in horror cinema is an interest of mine. And seeing how they handle it very mm-hmm. seriously at the beginning, like, they're not making it a spectacle. Mm-hmm. They're like, no, this is actually a terrifying, like, it feels like an exploitation movie. Like, Basket Casey, like, very much yeah. like you are in a bad part of town. And the way that this movie sets it up with Dee Wallace, and I forgot that she was in this, and she's just uh-huh. incredible in this film, especially in that beginning section where you're like, oh, this is not just a good old entertaining werewolf movie. Like, this is a movie that has uh-huh. a lot, like, much deeper things to talk about, but also has really cool werewolves. And I uh-huh. greatly appreciate that, because I love American Werewolf in London, but I think it's a little bit more cut and dry, which is not a bad thing at all. But I think that was very much going for more of the spectacle of the werewolf. And this, I feel like there obviously is a lot of spectacle, but it's not, it's more focused on the character growth even more, which I appreciate. And I really loved how what Dante and I forgot the writer's name, of course, already, Doug.
John Sayles, yeah.
Yeah, John like Sayles, how they dug in to that. It's just, holy cow. Thank you for making me finally watch this movie.
Yeah, no, it's super good. I mean, Sayles, he had worked with Dante on Piranha, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And I think, was this the same year that, when did Alligator come out? He did Alligator too, didn't he?
Yeah, Alligator was the year before, 1980. Okay.
All right. Yep. Yeah, so, I mean, Sayles, Sayles understands how a monster movie works, you know? And so he's able to,
he sure does,
like, ring those bells as he goes around the carousel so, like, efficiently that gives him room to do those other things that you're talking about, Mary Beth, you know, to engage things that matter. Like, that's the fun of genre for me, is as long as you ring the bells in the middle spaces, you can do whatever you want and have a lot of fun. And the other stuff is fun, too. It's all fun. That's the good part, you know?
So this was based on a book. I've never read the book. Have you?
I've read it a few times, yeah.
Is it good?
It's not great. I know that Dante and Brandner had a lot of friction because Dante and all his press would talk bad about, you know, Gary Brandner's novel, and Gary Brandner would, you know, sometimes be there, which made things super awkward. But I mean, it's the same thing that Kubrick says about The Shining. He says you take like, he considered The Shining to be a cheap genre novel that you can take the structure from and put some real character in, you know, which I don't necessarily agree with that, but I think that's what a lot of directors were thinking, is that the genre fields are lucrative to mine if you have the nuance and the character development abilities to tell a real story, you know? I'm not saying for sure that's how Joe Dante went into it, of course, but I do think Joe Dante, the same way Spielberg improved the novel Benchley's Jaws, I think Dante improved Gary Brandner's novel, The Howling, you know?
Yeah, so I've not read it, but I did look at, like, the Wikipedia has, like, a plot synopsis of it. Okay. So I was kind of digging into that to sort of see what the differences were, because I heard that from what I had read, it was different than Joe Dante didn't necessarily like it, hired John Sayles to come in and basically rewrite the script. Mm-hmm. And I can see, like, some of the, particularly, like, the opening, kind of the seediness. The book seems to make it a little bit more explicit that she was sexually assaulted and had a miscarriage. But, like, it still has similar beats that I can see a through line. But I think what John Sayles does is he makes it really uncomfortable, because there's some satire in this movie, just like there was in Piranha and Alligator. There's some silliness in it, and there's some fun. But when you have that mixed with the very intense subject matter that it's tackling, it does kind of put you in an uncomfortable place that I think is intentional and really elevates the film for me.
Oh, I completely agree. And I do think that Sayles and Dante are kind of poking fun at the, I don't know, New Age therapeutic movement that was big at the time, you know?
I got The Brood vibes a little bit. Have you seen The Brood? It felt very much like that getaway in The Brood, but it felt like it was making fun of that. When did The Brood come out?
I'd guess 82 or 83, but I'm not sure anymore.
79. Okay.
Yeah, so that's a long
they're
time
operating
ago.
In a similar time period of, like, New Age weirdos in turtlenecks and nice cardigans telling women how to feel about their own sexuality.
Exactly. But also there's the hardly whispered message that you can't trust these authorities. You know, these authorities are monstrous themselves, of course. Like this guy who's like Dr. Wagner, who's the expert, the TV expert, he is part of the problem, you know. He's not actually there to help people. He's there to feed people to the colony sometimes.
You know, just casually getting people, like, luring people to your New Age therapeutic place to feed them to your werewolf priestess, who just, like, is so obviously a priestess. Can we talk about her? Because, like, Dee Wallace and her husband come to this colony. There's, like, a nice beach party. Everyone's vibing. And then there's the, like, everyone looks like a normal, like, Northern California, like, kind of vibe. And then there's the priestess who's, like, in all black and has, like, a headband and just looks like a wolf. And you're like, well, there she is. Mm-hmm. And I love that, though. But it's just very funny where I'm like, well...
Yeah.
We are not wasting any time telegraphing what's going on here. And I appreciate that. She, it's just very funny.
And she, it's wonderful. I like that a lot too. And she doesn't cloak herself. Everybody else speaks in double entendres, but she pretty much speaks in, like, single entendres. You know, she
her and her brother TC, I think is his name. That,
yeah.
Who and wears, then of course like we've... fur the whole time, and I'm like, I mean, are we?
Yeah, I know. And Eddie Quist is their brother too. You know, that's kind of neat. This whole Quist family. Like, you know, I've got a list of aliases that I always think I'm going to use at hotels. I never do. But one of them is Eddie Quist. Like Eddie Quist and John Lee Pettimore. Those are my two main aliases I want to use.
Oh my God. I like how you have them to use them, but never do. You're like, ooh, no, never mind. You're like, I'm going to do it. Nope, never mind. Never mind. I love that.
Yeah.
Wow. So I got to know, because like we talked before we started talking about this conversation about The Howling. You mentioned werewolves. Were you a fan of werewolves before you saw this movie, or how? What was your relationship to werewolves both post and pre this movie?
Pre this movie, I don't think I knew about them. Post this movie, they were my religion, you know, and they kind of still are. They're still by far my favorite horror creature. Like some people love Cthulhu, I love werewolves, you know, and I've never fallen out of love with them. Not at all. No.
I've always been a werewolf guy as well. They're my favorite, honestly.
I also wanted to be a werewolf in elementary school, so I get that. Like, I would, like, howl at the moon and, like, eat lunch meat and be like, I'm eating raw meat. It was bologna. Like, what the fuck? But, like, I would tell people I was a werewolf. So, like, I get that. Like, I wanted to be a werewolf so bad. And a vampire, too. Again, either one, depended on the day. But, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But, you know, talking vampires and werewolves, I always thought that Near Dark in, what, 87 kind of brought them together. You know, like, it was vampires living what I consider to be a werewolf lifestyle, you know?
Yeah, the very nomadic kind of lifestyle that they associate with. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah.
Oh, so Mary Beth, I have to know, because you were talking about the telegraphing of Marcia and all that kind of stuff. Were you surprised at how the whole story kind of came together as an adult watching it? Or because like I'm always curious, because as a kid, it surprised the heck out of me.
I mean, like, I got it pretty quickly, but it didn't ruin it for me, because I was like, OK, they're werewolves. But like, how is that going to play out for everyone here? Like, how does Dee Wallace factor into this? How does her husband? How do her colleagues? Because they have a lot of cool stuff. It's not just the couple going to the colony. We also have her colleagues kind of doing research on the serial killer at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so I had a feeling, and I kind of was like, oh, they didn't show Eddie when he died. Like, we kind of know, like, unfortunately, as an adult, I was like, okay, that's probably going to come back. But I still... Mm-hmm. Like, his reveal is so fucking gross and weird that, like, it didn't matter. So it's, like, I think it felt, yes, some of the beats felt predictable, but it was done so effectively that I didn't care.
Yeah.
I think because, like, again, and we'll talk about this, I do have some issues with Dee Wallace's character, but as, like, a sexual assault survivor myself, and how they have her as kind of, like, the victim character a little bit too much, and have a lot of men save her, really kind of pisses me off. But I mean, like, I get it, it's 81, whatever, but still, I want to talk about that, because like, I just her character is the center of this, and I feel like a lot of her agency is so often ripped away on purpose sometimes, but in the movie also, like, all of a sudden she becomes like a screaming damsel, which is kind of a bummer, because the entire beginning she's set up as this badass who's like going to confront a serial killer. Is like not afraid of anything. And I understand that, like, trying to talk about the PTSD aspects of what she experienced, but I think the movie lets her down a little bit to become like kind of a male savior narrative in a way that was a bummer, personally. And not that I don't love that, I still really like this movie, but I think like that was a bit of a letdown in terms of her development as the film progressed.
Yeah, I agree. And like, all these werewolf stories and zombie stories, like, really all these monster encounter stories built into, like, the first probably 50%, maybe 60% is an expositional arc where people go to the library, the microfiche, and they figure out, oh, this, you know? And instead of Dee Wallace doing that, you're right, she's just back on her heels screaming. Her two coworker friends from the news station are the ones on that expositional arc, digging up stuff, getting books, buying silver bullets, all that stuff. And that
going to the occult bookstore led by Dick Miller.
Oh, I know, that's so good. He's so good at that too, isn't he?
He is.
As I understand, a lot of the props in that bookstore are from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know?
I did hear that, yeah.
Wait, really? Yeah. Oh, that's cool shit.
Yeah, that's super cool. But oh, you know, as far as her character's development, do you all like Karen's development? I do like how Eddie Quest, the first time we see him, he's basically an exhibitionist werewolf. You know, he's like, look at me, look what I can do. And then at the end, when he's killing people, he keeps transforming, which transformations must cost so many calories. I don't see how he can do it over and over in a single day, but never mind okay. That.
Look, I think about this. I think about the logistics of werewolf transformations too often. Yeah. I'm like, okay, so like, How many calories do you burn? What happens to your organs? What kind of damage are you doing to your organs with every transformation? Yeah. Like, I'm so sorry about your clothes for the, mm-hmm. the destruction of your clothes. Yeah. And like, really, like what is the calorie intake you need on a daily basis, mm-hmm. especially on a full moon?
I know.
Especially this transformation.
Yeah, this transformation. I mean, both calories and like wardrobe costs. Those are things you got to factor in. Yeah. You know, to being a werewolf.
That's why the priestess is in like just cloth the whole time. She's just like ready to like whip it off and be ready to transform, which is honestly the right way to do it.
Too many nice clothes.
For sure. But talking about Karen's development, I do like how Eddie is a exhibitionist werewolf, and then at the end, she becomes an exhibitionist werewolf. She does it for the whole world on that news segment.
You're right.
You know? And that's really good parallel structuring on John Sayles' part, I feel like.
I love this ending with her reveal when like, because like a lot of times we get it, the werewolf kills, you know, we kill the werewolf. And then we're just sort of left with like, what do we do from here? And a lot of times it's mysterious and no one ever like, you know, finds out about it. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, here she's like going on the news to be like, no, it's such a fun ending that like we're on the news, which is another kind of bit of interesting plotting device, because the news in this does not get a very good rap from John Sayles in terms of like the media, the way they in which they sort of like use her trauma for viewers. Mm-hmm. And then also the way in which like the news is just recycling a bunch of like really big grandiose stories, so that the point when she transforms in this harrowing moment at the very end, we get like little clips of people like, special effects these days, you know, it's like no one believes it. And I just love the way in which it sets up the media to be like, oh, they talk about everything that this could just be fake. Like, we're just not even going to, like, listen to it. It's such a smart ending.
Mm-hmm. It totally feels so modern. I feel like I know it's not a new ending, but it just, especially with the way that this film focuses on watching, which I was really, really impressed by from the very beginning when she goes into the porn theater, basically, and is watching a woman be, like, aggressively raped. And we don't know if it is an actual snuff film or whatnot, but there's this emphasis throughout about someone watching you. And we talked about like exhibitionists, because there's even a moment when she goes on to the news for the first time before they go to the colony, and you see the apparatus, like the aperture, like look at her. And it just rings in a really smart way for 1981 John Dante werewolf film about the male gaze. And I don't think it was like intentionally male gaze, but with her and the way she is constantly being looked at and picked apart, it is a really fascinating look at looking and gazes and how the body, particularly female bodies, are just like used for information and spectacle. And it's so smart in how it like very, it doesn't hit you over the head with it, but it visually telegraphs that so well. It's like, I'm surprised when people don't talk about that and how, like, this is a movie interrogating how we look at people and their trauma. And I just think that's so amazing for the 80s. We don't really think about that kind of thing in the 80s.
Well, tell you the truth, I think you can go from Peeping Tom in 1960 to The Howling in 1981 to Jordan Peele's Nope. Those are like a spectacle gaze trilogy, it feels like, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Well, I was thinking about this. You were talking about the way in which the male gaze on Karen, because there's that moment where, you know, they have her up on to like present, and it's the moment when she's looking at the aperture and she sees the porn film play in it. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, they're talking about the culture of violence and they're really hyping up like, you know, violent media. And she freaks out because she's having that PTSD moment. And her, like, the manager, I'm not sure what they call him, but the person that's in charge is like, oh, maybe she's pregnant. Like, just dismissing her for her woman problems is basically like, what?
Yeah.
And there's so many little digs in here that are just so interesting in regards to what you were talking about, Mary Beth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, 100%. I agree, man. Yeah. You know, I wonder with Eddie Quist's, like, exhibitionism, like, I wonder if it is just, like, a fetish of his, or if he's trying to knit together the werewolf world and the human world. Like, that, because that's what that act does, you know? It exposes werewolves, and the world then has to contend or deal with them. And so, I mean, he is a bad dude. He's serial killing. He's doing all kinds of terrible stuff. But, I wonder if his, like his major malfunction is that he's tired of being dismissed by the world.
Well, I think the movie also kind of addresses that a little bit, where there seems to be like a friction in between the colony about whether they want to hide, because there's a comment about how, you know, society has moved on and we haven't moved with society. Mm-hmm. And so it does seem that there's a little bit, I kind of wish there's a little bit more to that, that the movie dug into a bit more, because it does seem as if, like, there is that schism of like, should we show ourselves to the world or what? And I think it ties into Eddie's character. And then, of course, what happens at the end, it's, I don't know. There's some interesting thematic things in there that still resonate.
I agree. And I mean, it's kind of like it's teeing up the ball for True Blood to out the vampires, you know, I feel like that's a direction that the Howling series franchise could have gone, you know, that would have been pretty cool.
Now, one thing that I'm obsessed about, I think one of the reasons I really like werewolf movies is the transformation sequence. Mm-hmm. I think
those are always like
the big things, whether it's the way in American Werewolf in London or this, or even like in Trick or Treat with the way that the women's like skin just slides right off their bodies. Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what is like your favorite werewolf? Because you're a big werewolf fan. What's your favorite werewolf transition on film?
Oh, my favorite transformation. That's a hard call. I love the product of the transformation in The Howling. That's probably my favorite. I love these big-eared bipedal werewolves, which are basically the same werewolves you get in Dog Soldiers, you know? And those are just really off-putting to me. But as far as the mechanics or the goopiness of the transformation, I do like American Werewolf in London. And the difference in The Howling and American Werewolf in London, I mean, it's Rick Baker and Rob Bottin. They're like teacher and mentor, of course. But
right.
In American Werewolf in London, what John Landis filmed was the pain of it. In The Howling, what Joe Dante shot was the wondrousness of it, I guess, the expressiveness of it. And I'm probably more in tune with John Landis's "it really, really, really hurts" idea, you know. But but as far as transformation, I really like that transformation in Hemlock Grove too.
That one is good.
That's a really good it's where the werewolf eats its own kind of afterbirth a little bit, you know, and its like eyes pop out. It's pretty wicked.
But that's really cool. I've always wondered, like, do you just leave a fucking like flesh sack on the ground when you like, where does all your flesh go?
But also, what's there's a movie, and I always get the words in the wrong order. It's like, let's see, Werewolf in a Mexican Woman's Prison. I think that's the name of it. And it's not the highest quality movie you'll ever see in your life, you know? but
like, it's kind of like that, are you sure?
Like, it's an example of the quality here. Like, these two women, as punishment, get staked out in the sun on chains, wearing, like, some prison version of bikinis. And because they're so thirsty, the only way that they can survive is to lick the sweat off of each other's bodies, which I don't think is actually a survival tactic. You know, I don't think that's going to help you live or anything.
Probably not.
It's over the top stupid and insulting. But
I'm kind of.
But the transformation in that is like the person who's about to transform starts kind of shaking real fast, and they lean their head back. And then, kind of like in Neil Marshall's The Company of Wolves, a mouth kind of erupts up through the human mouth, a wolf snout, and then the person peels their human self off of that wolf, and the wolf stands up and is a werewolf. And that's really, really cool, unless you think about it, because if you think about it, it's like nested gnomes. Like, every time the werewolf and the human is smaller and smaller, you know?
Oh my gosh, can you imagine a story
Russian nesting dolls of werewolves?
They have like an expiration date because they know they're just going to keep getting smaller until they wink out of existence.
Yeah.
Oh my god, and then we're plagued by atomically tiny werewolves that we can't see, and they're getting all of us, and we all become a society of werewolves. Oh my god, we've written something. Cut this out, Terry. We've really got something on our hands here.
That'd be fun. But I never liked in Twilight, I guess, where Jacob and his pack transform, like they run and they jump and they come down as werewolves, you know, like that to me, like you're not paying the price for these powers, you know, and I do appreciate in Twilight how they think ahead and they tie their clothes into a pouch on their leg. So when they come back to human, they've got some clothes to put on.
That's the one pro. That answers my question in one place. Oh my god.
I'm glad that you talked about the bipedalness of these werewolves, because honestly, this is the kind of werewolf I love. This is the kind of werewolf that is a werewolf to me. Mm-hmm. Like I appreciate American Werewolf in London, but the fact that it's kind of just a big wolf. Like Twilight, where they turn into wolves. I'm like, no, I want a wolf man. I want a man or a woman that is also a werewolf, that stands on two legs, that is the big hulking beast. And I love the design on here. Like the moment when Terry, which you never hear my name in movies. And so when I hear Terry, I'm always like, it's Terry. And I think it's funny because her boyfriend maybe is Chris, and that's my brother's name. So it's really weird.
That is weird.
Chris and Terry in this. But But yeah, so that moment when she is like being chased by him, and we get to see like the bigness of the werewolf and those big ears. I love the ears.
The ears. Mm-hmm. What big ears you have.
Exactly. Oh, so exactly. Good.
This is the movie I think about whenever I think about werewolves, because this is what I want werewolves to be.
I agree. I think in American Werewolf in London, it's kind of like a bodybuilder hyena, you know? And that's definitely scary, don't get me wrong. But it's not it's not the werewolf I want to subscribe to, you know?
No.
Yeah. You know, actually, one of my favorite of all the werewolves is Professor Lupin in the Harry Potter series, you know? I love him. I mean, he is a CGI wolf, but he turns into, he's like lithe, and this is a werewolf that can run through the trees like a cheetah, you know? It's really, really fast.
I did like I did like the design of his werewolf, like the hairless, like sickly looking freaky thing. I'm like, that I like, because it feels uncanny. You're like, something right there.
It does.
But the howling werewolves are also kind of horny, which I am into. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, obviously, like, one of our first transformation sequences is while people are fucking. But there is just, like, this, like you talked about, Stephen, with, like, the pain in American Werewolf in London in the howling. It feels almost erotic. I wouldn't say fully erotic, but, like, when his face is pulsating. And it just, like, and the howls feel, like, desirous. It's very kind of, like, sensual more than I've ever seen with a werewolf transformation, which I'm super into, which is, like, so interesting to think about, like, pain and pleasure, very Hellraiser vibes to the transformation. Yeah.
That's a good point. Maybe Clive Barker was born artistically when he saw the howling, you know?
There you go. I do love, so, like, the idea, I think there's, I think my big problem with the script is there's a lot of really good ideas that I kind of wish that they had fleshed out a bit more. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of like repression is a thing that starts off this movie, where it's like we have the doctor talking about how in polite society we're basically trying to repress the animalism inside, and we have that represented with Karen's husband. What's his name? Is it Roy?
Bill.
Yeah, Bill. So we have that with Bill, and where like he doesn't eat meat, and he goes here, and after he gets bit, he's like, oh, this meat's really good. He's like, he's like giving into those animalistic, you know, urges. And so there's a little bit of that in here. And I kind of wish it went a little bit further, to be honest, with sort of that repression, because we have like the idea of like polite society and, you know, trying to basically what elevates us from wolves or from animals. And Karen even says at the very end, in an interesting way, where she says she talks about the choice that makes us human, and for some that choice was taken away. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of also ties a little bit into like the idea of, that if she was sexually assaulted, that was taken away from her too. And so there's some interesting ties there with repression and stuff. And I don't know, just like some of the other things that are in here, I kind of wish, and maybe it's because you have to rewrite a script and so you're trying to do it really quick, but there's some things in there I wish were percolating a little bit more.
I agree. And I think that budgetary constraints are why the last act of The Howling it's kind of wonky a little bit, you know? And as I understand, it's because they just flat ran out of money and they were having, what, they shot this in like 28 days or something, you know? So they, I think they probably couldn't do everything that they initially hoped to do, you know?
And I did read, I think that's why the werewolf fucking scene in front of the bonfire is animated because they didn't have the money to pull it off.
I was going
to
ask. I was like, what?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I thought I had a fever and I was like, am I just crazy? Like, am I seeing things? No?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's definitely different.
But not just my brain.
Talking about that, like repressing the animal instincts, that was also like something I'm very interested in as far as werewolves go. And so when I did my novel Mongrels, which is a werewolf novel, there's a chapter that deals with that, you know, like the werewolves who decide to tamp down their instincts and live as people in the suburbs are what other werewolves call sheep, you know? And the problem is that those sheep, once or twice a month, they kind of wake up and sleepwalk and go out and kill people. So they're actually worse than werewolves because they don't know what they're doing. You know, they lose it.
Yeah. Right.
Have either of you seen The Howling 2? I've heard it is not good, but
it's
not great.
I've seen it once.
It's very different tonally, I feel, from what I've seen.
It is, yes. It's not great. Howling 3 and 4 are pretty solid, actually, I think.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't think
and there's either, like seven.
Yeah, there's a lot.
There's seven sequels.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, and
really?
I think the most recent one of the most recent ones is kind of like a reboot, if I understand. And number four is actually a more faithful adaptation of the novel than The Howling is, you know. Let's see. Is number two, is that My Sister is a Werewolf? Your Sister is a Werewolf.
Your Sister is a Werewolf is number two. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the later ones, I'm going to guess it's five. It could be four. I don't know. The werewolves transform. The transformations are wild. It's no longer latex bubbles in a face. Now the way they transform is they melt like Crayolas in the sun into a puddle and they rise again as werewolves. You know, it's wild.
Oh, wow.
It's like a butterfly. You melt down and then you reconstitute yourself. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty out there, man. Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah. No, for sure.
So we need to talk about the final shot of this movie. I know Mary Beth is obsessed with the slow pan out.
Well, okay.
Or pan in, actually.
This movie is incredibly bleak. We have this, it starts with a sexual assault and it ends with Dee Wallace getting shot live on camera with nobody believing that werewolves are real. It is, her trauma has basically changed her into something she can no longer stand to be, and she has to be destroyed, which is, a whole can of worms that annoys me. But 1981, I'm trying to keep the context in my head. But again, it's bleak, and all of a sudden we have this, bleak-ass ending, and then we go to a diner where everyone is watching the news, and the guy orders a drink and a food and goes, hamburger for the lady. And the camera pans over and it's our priestess and he says, how do you want it cooked? And she goes, rare. And if that is not the funniest, darkest, in other movies, I'd be like, are you fucking serious? You're ending it on that note. But for this movie, it just the pitch black comedy of it all. And then to just, with the credits, slow pan onto a piece of raw hamburger cooking on the grill. I mean, come on. What a perfect ending for a werewolf movie. So tongue-in-cheek, so pitch black.
No, I totally agree. It's wonderful. And I love how it holds on that sizzling hamburger through the credits, you know?
Through the credits.
Yeah, you watch it cook. You watch it cook.
Yeah, you do. And it's so neat how that dude, he says a steak for me and a burger for her. It's like that thing at the bar where you buy somebody a drink, but instead of buying somebody a drink, you're buying him a burger, which is a weird thing.
I love it. Know? Yeah. For the pretty lady, a raw piece of hamburger. You're like, I've never been more turned on in my entire life. Like this woman who is oozing sexuality most of the movie is rare. And you're like, God damn it. This is so good and so ridiculous, but so fitting for this whole movie.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah. Yeah, it totally is.
even before that, though, I love that, because so the news lady, we have the news lady's turned into a werewolf, one of the kids says as they're watching it, right? And she looks like a cute mutt. It's just a close-up of her face, and she looks like a
Pomeranian.
Yeah, she does. Well, people say she looks like a young Wookiee, you know?
Oh my god, she does.
She does. She really does. I was like, she doesn't look scary. She kind of looks so cute. I'd keep her.
Yeah.
She's a little button nose and everything.
I talked to Dee Wallace in a green room once about that final scene, and she was saying she had it in her contract where she didn't want to be like a grody werewolf, you know? Like, she didn't want she didn't want a lot of stuff on her, so they had to find a way to make it like a kind of cute werewolf, you know?
It is a cute werewolf, but I love this little cute dog. Like, it adds to the horror of it. Is the one that gets shot down with like this really cute face, and then it cuts to an ad of a dog eating dog food.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
it's so
okay, good. I see what you're doing here. And then it turns into her ordering the rare burger. I love the way that plays out.
Oh, that's really good. And we get there through Mick Garris on a couch saying whatever he says, you know, which is so cool.
Was him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Aw, yeah. Mick.
Yeah, it's so cool. So cool. But I like that guy in the bar when the camera's panning down to get to her at the end. He says, he says, that was a real transformation. And they say, you're drunk. And he says, I might be, but that was a real transformation or whatever, you know. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't a real transformation.
Yeah. Right. Wow. And no one believes it. Yeah. Everyone's just like, it's special effects these days. It's so good.
You know, that bar feels like the same bar at the end of Elf when they're reading the Christmas list, you know, and that guy, he wants whatever he wants. And they're like, is that you? He's like, no, it's another guy.
Who wants the salon? It's like the nail salon set. Yeah, he's like, must be a different Jack Johnson or something like that. Oh my god, I thought the same thing. That makes me feel good. And like, we have a linked mind, because I was like, this feels like the end of Elf, which is a very weird comparison to make. But yes, I did feel the same way.
The through line from Howling to Wolf.
Elf.
Elf.
Yeah.
John Favreau, were you inspired by The Howling? Yes or no? Yes, like, get him on the line. I want to know.
Yeah. We must know.
Yeah. It is weird that, is her name Marcia? Is that right? The Marcia Quist?
Yeah.
Yeah. That she wears the same clothes. Like, she's like a superhero. She wears the same clothes all the time. You know? She's the Charlie Brown of werewolf priestesses or something. You know?
She's got a simple uniform. She's got a simple uniform. Yeah. She knows what she needs. She knows what works. And it's perfect.
I mean, you know, she's probably the smartest of them all, because she knows what's going to happen to the clothes. So you might as well just, like, find something you like and buy 20 pairs of them.
Totally agree, man. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, nobody, when what's the guy's name? The news reporter who gets the silver bullets, who looks like Seth.
Chris.
Chris. Yeah, Chris. I think nobody questions when he brings a hunting rifle into the news station. You know, like, that's pretty wild. Like, what are you doing with that rifle?
The 80s were a different time.
Like a little six shooter or something. It's a, it's a big ass gun.
Just
I'm just gonna stand this in the corner. You don't worry about it, man.
Don't worry about this. we're diverting from the established script, but don't worry about this gun that I brought with me.
Don't worry about it. It's totally fine. Yeah. Nothing weird is going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one final thing, because the thing that's I think surprised me on this watch is I remember the humor. I remember like the werewolf transformation, but there are some actually terrifying moments in this. I think the opening sequence where we're following her is just it's a perfectly paced little thriller all in on its own, where I was like tense even though I knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
But I think the way in which it kind of ties into what you were talking about, Mary Beth, with like the way that she's always being looked at, where she's obviously out of her element in here and people are like staring at her, and she's causing everyone, all the men in the porno shop, to flee because there's a woman in the porno shop. But like,
God, a scary woman with porn. A woman can't have desire.
Right. But the way it is filmed, it was so intense. And that moment where he is behind her and we can't see him and we're just seeing the horrible thing that he's making her watch, it got me like really tense as I was watching it. And then also the sequence where Terry is in Marsh's house and it's so quiet and you're just like waiting for something to jump out and chase her. It's Joe Dante's really good at filming those horror sequences. I think we think a lot of it with him with like the horror comedy of Gremlins and whatnot, but he is really good at creating a very intense set piece, I think.
I totally agree. And you know, that opening sequence, I mean, stylistically and camera work wise, it would fit in Taxi Driver. It's the same kind of stuff. You know?
Yeah. I was thinking about that. I was thinking a lot about movies like Taxi Driver. I mentioned Basket Case, like those seedy movies that like are very grounded in reality. Like, well, not Basket Case, but parts of it feel grounded. Yeah. Like that groundedness of the whole thing, which I think again makes it so much more effective because it feels like, oh, this is actually, it's LA, right? LA.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like this actually feels like we're in LA in the 80s. We're grounding this. So when the werewolves come in, it's even crazier that like, oh no, like you don't need a fantastical world for werewolves to exist. Like they could exist in even in like seedy Los Angeles. In fact, it makes sense that they would. And I love that in terms of selling the fear.
It's a very like grindhouse aesthetic, or it would fit well on 42nd Street back in that time, you know, in New York, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And I was just thinking now as you're talking, Mary Beth, that I think that might be what was so off-putting for me as a kid, because I grew up watching the 1930s, the Wolfman, you know, where it's always, or even like, even the opening parts of American Werewolf in London, where it's like in the moors, or it's some, you know, fog and mist, and it's England, it's that kind of aspect. And here, it's in a city, and it's modern, and it feels like we are in some place that someone would actually live nowadays. Mm-hmm. And so I think that might have been one of the things that kind of caused me to be like, this is, I don't know how I feel about this as a kid, because it's unlike anything that I'd ever seen before with werewolves.
Yeah. Oh, totally agree.
Do we want to wrap this up and give it our rating out of 5?
Sure.
It sounds good.
Hell yeah. All right, Terry, how many rare hamburger patties out of 5 do you give the Howling?
You know, I hadn't seen this movie in a long time, and I was like, what is this going to watch going to be? But I'll tell you, from the very opening to the very end, I was just enraptured again. This movie, I don't think it's talked about a whole lot in reference to like the werewolf mythology, because I think American Werewolf in London steals a lot of its thunder. But I will say, I think this movie is absolutely fantastic. I really like the look of the werewolves. That's really how I consider werewolves to be. If I were to think, yeah, that's a werewolf, this is a werewolf for me. It's good. It's intense. It's funny. It's doing some interesting things with narrative. You know, this is a 4 rare hamburger patties out of 5 for me. I really enjoy this one. And this was a great rewatch. What about you, Mary Beth?
I think I'm going to have to also give it 4 raw hamburger, rare hamburger patties. I think I love how this is, you know, it's not perfect, but I love how it's trying to work within like the frame of sexual assault and survivors and trying to kind of look at the werewolf through that lens. I think that's really interesting. And especially in the 80s and the effects work and Dee Wallace's performance. I mean, everything about this, I'm so glad I finally saw. And it holds up even seeing it now as an adult, knowing, you know, being able to maybe predict those plot points still didn't make it any less effective for me. So I'm going to have to go with 4. Steven, you have the final word. How many hamburger patties do you give this?
This is my favorite werewolf film of 81, for sure. I like it more than American Werewolf in London. I think it's a lot more fun, actually. I mean, American Werewolf in London leans into the comedy aspect more, for sure. But this has Slim Pickens. Anything with Slim Pickens, I'm going to love, I'm pretty sure. You know, he's like the sheriff I think of when I think of sheriffs. But I would also, I mean, I want to say 4.5. I don't know if y'all do halves, though. But
oh, yeah.
Okay,
half a hamburger.
Well, I guess if so people can understand my rating, I would probably say I would give this 4.5, whereas I would give American Werewolf in London like a 2.75, and I would give Ginger Snaps a 5, a straight 5, you know?
If that situates it in the werewolf spectrum,
any, you know?
Yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us to talk about The Howling. Where can the listeners find you? And the floor is yours to plug away with everything you can talk about.
Oh, man. I mean, True Believers is getting kickstarted right now. That's something that's going to have a lot of you know, dead conventioneers in it. Earthdivers is wrapping up. That's easy to find on any comic book stand. Angel of Indian Lake is just out, but you probably want to read the first two first, so the third one will make sense. And I've got I Was a Teenage Slasher coming in July. And as for where to find me, just type my name into a search engine. I'll pop up somewhere. People always think I'm on Instagram. That's actually my publisher who's on Instagram. wearing me like a skin, but that's fine.
Who is the real werewolf?
Yeah, exactly. I should pull it off and be a littler and littler me. You know? But yeah, just you can find me wherever. I just type my name in and I'll show up, you know?
I just want to say very briefly that my introduction to My Heart is a Chainsaw was the Audible book, the audiobook, narrated by Kara G. Her performance in that is so good.
It is.
There are some narrators that just, I think, elevate a story. Mm-hmm. And she is one of them. Like, I loved her Jade.
No,
I just want to say
you're
that.
You're totally right. Yeah.
That was.
Yeah. No,
Kara, she was great.
Kara kills it so good. And Isabella Starr LeBlanc, who does Reaper and Angel, she kills it as well. And what's really cool.
I love her. She's so good. Isabella Starr LeBlanc. Sorry. She was in on Pet Sematary Bloodlines.
Yeah. She was, and also True Detective Night Country too. She's amazing. But then in the third one, Barbara Crampton does the long prologue, which is the coolest, you know. And then Stephen King does a cameo in it. It's all fun, man. Yeah,
that's so amazing. Cool. That's gonna be so cool as a horror lover.
Yeah, I've been impressed with the Audible, the audio narrator for this series. Thank you. Just. It's so good. Good.
Yeah, it really is. That Michael Noble's the guy who produces, directs it, and he has really good like instincts as just for how to do stuff. And he runs it past me, and I've never said no. I'm always like another great idea because he's good with this. It's his world, you know.
Hell yeah! All right, listeners, you've heard from us, but we want to hear from you. What was your experience with The Howling? You can let us know by sending us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us directly on social media. I am at MB McAndrews on Twitter and at MB.McAndrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gailey Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast on social media. We are at Scarred Podcast on Twitter and Blue Sky and at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if it's not the 16th yet, please vote for us for a rondo.
Woo! Thank you to Eric Power for artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there, but most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.